various structures in Lakeville and even in Millerton, because it looked as if there were not much possibility here. And finally, the opportunity came up to buy the present tract, which was then owned by Metz and Sharon, and he had been unwilling to break it up before, but we were able to get this. And then we sort of shepherded it through various zoning requirements, and finally were able to build a building in 1982, and we occupied it at the beginning of 1983, and I've been there since. And,
it's already been 6 years or
yeah.
so.
Yeah, well, this is a matter of raising
like
yourself
yesterday.
By your bootstraps, and you don't think you can, but you somehow
yeah,
manage
you
it.
Do it.
Well, there's that old proverb, where there's a will, et cetera.
I guess.
Here are some things that we run across from time to time, and we spoke about the Hessian soldiers in Mount Riga, but there's another one that we've heard about a couple of times, the Ankrum Screams. Do you know anything about that?
Well, the Ankrum Screams, if they're the same thing, this is a bit of lore. I think Harris Rossiter gave an interview to the journal a couple of years before he died. This must be 10 years ago anyhow. But he mentioned the Ankrum Screams, or Screamers, I think they were called.
Screamers, yes.
Yeah. But I never knew exactly what they were. They were sounds that you would hear on the mountains, but it was never clear to me why Ankrum was associated with them. I think this is part of the mountain lore with
sure.
little people and all sorts of things like that. Harris Rossiter was the last man born on the mountain. Of course, there were farms up there. You can still see the stone walls
yes.
and the orchards and this sort of thing.
What about the term raggies?
Well, I've heard various origins, and I have to believe that it's a corruption of Riga, the mountain. Riga, raggies. Who knows? Lila Nash always was very proud of her Raggy origin or Raggy origin, but I don't think she had an explanation of the origin of the word.
Yeah, no, we haven't found anybody. And those, one of the things I ran across and have looked for is the fact that some of the Shays Rebellion people were in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever run across that in any way?
Well, there is, of course, the monument to Shays Rebellion in the town of Sheffield on Bow Wow Road. So help me. It's a corruption of Pow Wow Road. But it's the road between the railroad crossing just north of Sheffield Village. As you're going up Route 7 toward Great Barrington, and you've been through Sheffield Village, and you make a swing a bit to the left and then straighten up again, and there's a crossing on the left. That's Bow Wow Road, and that goes up to South Egremont, near the Egremont Inn. And about halfway up on the right, you'll see a marker in a field there. The last battle of Shays Rebellion was fought there.
There's a new book at Hotchkiss School Library just mm-hmm. Last year on Shays Rebellion. The author, name of the author doesn't come to my mind at the moment, but he mentions recruiting and training taking place on Sharon Green.
Well, now that's something it doesn't strike a bell, but I tell you who would know. A man by the name of Roger Wunderlich, W-U-N-D-E-R-L-I-C-H,
right.
wrote a lot of historical pieces for the journal in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
Roger left here to complete a degree at SUNY down in Smithtown, Long Island, and I think he was going to teach.
Is he still living in Smithtown?
I think so.
Oh.
He's a guy older than I am, and he's just starting a teaching career, so more power to
Good
him.
Good for him, I
But, Roger did a lot of research on Shays Rebellion, and he wrote a number of pieces about this.
Well, in the Lakeville
in
Journal?
In the Lakeville Journal. They were on the viewpoint page.
I'll have to look that up. Approximately which year?
Well,
roughly.
If I had to guess, I'd say 1970. 1778. He helped Mary Lou market her Connecticut calendar, which was Connecticut 1978, I believe. And so he was working, I remember we were working with him about that time, and it may have been a year before this, but it was in that general period.
Great, I'll have to follow through on that. Another thing that we're looking for, Native American history, if there, we learned a little bit about, well, we didn't learn, what we learned is one statement that there was a Weetog settlement on Weetog Road.
I've heard that. I've heard that there was a settlement right quite near where the present Fair Acres farm is. I tell you who would know that very readily is the president of the American Indian
or the archaeological
institute.
Is that Hansen?
No, it's Ned.
I can get that.
Edward is his name, and I'll call you with that because I know him
okay.
Well, but I find more mental blocks coming up.
We all do. I'm not going to be very clear about this, but someone asked this morning about the hydraulic power company changes around the reservoir property. Are you acquainted with that?
I want to talk about the Horatio Ames Ironworks, and
Okay. Don't
let me forget that.
All right.
I'm familiar in a general way because I'm on the land trust, and we were the people who originally dug up this thing and saw the danger coming on it. The Bridgeport Hydraulic has been wanting to sell off excess lands for a while. It had a problem here in Salisbury in that it needed more capacity, and there's a federal EPA regulation that surface water supplies are supposed to be phased out unless they have a filtration system. Well, Bridgeport Hydraulic was faced with the problem of either putting in a filtration system for the Lakeville Reservoir or finding an alternative source. It would be cheaper, so they thought, to find an alternative source, so they started exploring in the Moore Brook watershed. Well, that set the land trust on edge because much of this is trust land because of the particular water course. In other words, it's a unique, very fragile ecosystem down there, and doing a lot of drilling or damming or whatever would upset the balance. And some of the land is owned by the Nature Conservancy, so we got the Nature Conservancy into the act and made it clear to Bridgeport Hydraulic that if it proceeded there, it was going to face some very expensive lawsuits. And so it then began considering the possibility of the Lakeville Reservoir, the filtration system. Well, it appeared at that point that Bridgeport Hydraulic was going to get a fantastic amount of money for that land. They own 460 acres up there.
Wow.
And it's quite choice land and magnificent views and all of that. But then we agreed on having an appraisal, and it develops that land without frontage that is in 5-acre mountain zoning. I guess some of it's in 2-acre zoning, but it would be enormously expensive to develop. And so the appraisal came in at less than a quarter, probably a fifth or a sixth of what they had hoped and expected of the thing. So suddenly their interest in selling it rather disappeared. We had undertaken and would work closely with the town to work with them, and we presented a proposition, and when I say we, I don't mean to speak for the town, but we talked this out with the selectmen and so forth. We presented them a tentative proposition whereby the town would if necessary, pay for the filtration system if they would guarantee to continue to use the reservoir and not threaten more brook and this sort of thing. And we had sort of a tacit understanding that that would be the case. And I believe that is still what is guiding now, but meanwhile their interest in selling the reservoir has diminished perceptibly. I wanted to talk about the Horatio Ironwood. Before Barnum and Richardson, of course, the big operator in the mid-19th century was the Horatio Ames Ironworks, which was on the Salisbury side of Falls Village in what is now Amesville. And you will note such, I think, nice little antique references as Puddler's Lane as a result of the Horatio Ames Ironworks. Anyhow, a spur of the Housatonic Railroad was built across the river on a bridge.
Is there a place actually called Puddler's Lane now?
Yes, Puddler's Lane where in Amesville, part of Salisbury.
Oh, in Amesville.
Off Sugar Mountain Road.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's some other little reminders. Anyhow, the Housatonic Railroad built a spur on a bridge across to serve the Horatio Ames Ironworks. And this was a big operation. You can see old woodcuts of it with locomotives puffing back and forth and smokestacks, all of this sort of thing. It had the responsibility for developing a field piece for the Army in the Civil War, and it did develop one that would shoot a projectile 5 miles. And they tested it at various points around this area, and all was going well until the Civil War suddenly came to an end, and the War Department canceled the contract, with Horatio Ames having spent all the money to develop the thing, and within a very few months they went bankrupt, and the whole thing just passed out of existence. This was part of the complex that was supposed to make Falls Village the new Chicago back in the 1850s. And there was even a canal built around the falls up there, and you can still see some of the stonework for it. But down behind the present powerhouse, down toward the high school from it, if you walk on those paths in the wood, you will see all sorts of breastworks and foundations in there that were supposed to be the industrial heart of this operation. And in my perambulating around, I wondered why I never could find any of the iron earthworks buildings or foundations. And suddenly the idea came to me that when the power dam was put in 1913, it of course flooded all of these out. So I've done some fooling around on the Salisbury side in there, and if you look down in some places you can see brick abutments down underwater. And they must have been the ironworks. Subsequently, the New Haven Railroad built a roundhouse on the Salisbury side of the river and used the same bridge for this, and that was still in existence in 1898, because you can see it on the 1898 map of Salisbury that is sold around. We have one, I'm sure you've seen.
Yes.
There's one in the town hall.
The Horatio Ames outfit then was out completely. There was nothing.
Out completely. Nothing
took its place.
Nothing left. Well, I guess Barnum Richardson took it over, but it wasn't in the same place. And of course, Barnum and Richardson was a big operation, and William Barnum was a U.S. senator from Connecticut, appointed by the General Assembly, and when he died, Grover Cleveland came to his funeral. So that he was an important fellow. Charlotte Reed was telling me that some room in her family's house, the house built by her grandfather over on Elm Street, fronting on Lake Onassis Pullman, had a room built for the Barnums.
See now. Well, we certainly have covered it. You're good. Bob, one of the things that I think strikes many of us is your citizenship responsibility and how involved you have been in the community, which of course is marvelous. What about projecting? What's going to happen to this town with some of the new realities that are here And also at the same time, would you give any advice to some of the younger people growing up here?
Well, I'm a great believer in reading history because I think you have to know where you've been before you know where you're going. And this is the thing that I miss the most in certain of our current attitudes and obsessions, that we don't make much use of history. And it's very important in Salisbury because we do have some traditions that are worth preserving. We have a tradition of civility in our town, which is fairly rare in my experience. And we find that except on very partisan biennial elections, we rather like each other here. Mm-hmm. And that's a nice thing to have, and I think it can fail. New England has some interesting things to teach us. I think it's interesting that of all the New England states, Connecticut and Massachusetts probably share the most institutions in common. They're really very similar, so that if you're reading Massachusetts history, you can read in Connecticut history and vice versa. But obviously the tradition of the volunteer society is much larger than these two states, but it flourishes here. And it's, I think, something terribly precious that is really very much endangered, not merely by what's happened in the percentage of homes that now is occupied as second homes and is not full-time residents, but in the exodus of young people, which is happening all over the country, and the draw of the cities. The depopulation of the countryside during the working day is what we're talking about. It is progressively more difficult to staff the volunteer fire company, the ambulance service. It's hard to find volunteers to work with the organizations such as mental health or the public health nursing and things like that. Well, these are to me what make the vitality of a small town. It's a cooperative endeavor, and it's a cooperative endeavor in which Mrs. Got Rocks and Mr. Got Nothing work side by side, and nobody asks what your background is, and it's a rather nice thing. We also have depended in this town, we've been extraordinarily fortunate in that people of money have taken an interest in the town, have loved the town, have given many of them in ways that is very little appreciated today. We have benefited, well, take what the Belchers did with the town grove. I'll bet you not one person in 10 using the town grove realizes how the town acquired it and that sort of thing. Or take the library, the Scovilles gave the library. And there are all sorts of things like that. Arnold Whitridge did an enormous amount for Noble Horizons that people don't realize. We don't have that kind of money or that kind of person today, at least visibly. They may exist and they may surprise us, but I'm working with the library on its capital campaign, and it's a little frightening to realize how heavily you've depended on a few big gifts in the past, and they ain't there. And we've got to find other ways of getting popular participation, and people are really going to probably have to pay a good bit more to keep the things they value. I feel that we have had not a free ride, certainly, and the people who find the tax burden onerous, I empathize with, but by comparison with other towns of this size or other towns in the area, we've been extraordinarily fortunate in Salisbury, and that little rooster is coming home to roost very quickly, because there are just lots of deferred needs that we have to meet, and it's going to be very expensive. How do you project the future? I would hope that the traditions I'm talking about, the New England style democracy, the town meeting where anyone can get up and speak his piece and isn't inhibited and does do it, is something very precious. And I think it's good to be suspicious of too much government at all levels, and this is not partisan. I just think it's something that you need to be aware of. And there's a sort of a fierce determination to be individual in these places. And I think that's marvelous. I also want a place where you can get lost. I hope not too many people get lost, because I think you have to pull your weight. But I do sympathize with the people from New York who just want to be up here where nobody can see them. There ought to be some place on our continent where you can do that.
How many of the, how big is the, or what proportion of the population are weekenders?
I have seen figures that between 57 and 60% of the properties now being occupied by people who are not full-time residents. And I believe that to be about right. The number of homes dark during the week has certainly, by my lights, at least doubled during the time we've been here.
How about the older age population in relation to the younger?
I don't know that you can say that it has grown particularly. I saw a statistic some years ago that Salisbury, I think next to Greenwich, had the second largest percentage of people over 65 in the state of Connecticut.
Oh, Greenwich and then Salisbury.
Yeah. And we may have surpassed that now, but certainly the advent of such a facility as Noble Horizons makes it possible for people who might have to retire elsewhere to stay here, and that's, I think, a great asset. We get their wisdom, we also keep their money here, if you want to be crass about it. But I think there's a boon in that. What I do believe in very strongly is a mix of population. I would hate to see this place become a gerontocracy, and there's some danger of that. And I'd hate to see it be all weekenders, there's some danger of that. I would love to see more part-time residents brought into the business of the community, and some of them play a very important and growing role. So you can't generalize on this. What we lack is facilities for young people to stay here. By the same token, though, I think it was you, Bob, the other day who remarked that it was Norm Sills who remarked that the kids almost have to get away and then come back. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true in almost every community in America. Otherwise, you're serving a life sentence. But we still very drastically lack not merely housing. We lack moderate income housing, but we lack economic opportunity for young people. There are just not that many jobs in our community for that sort of person.
And wouldn't you add social and cultural?
Yeah, I think you make those to a certain degree. We do attract some young people to our private schools and the faculties and so forth, but they don't always mix with the community. I'm really talking more attention to commercial activity, or I will mention that horrible word, industry. I believe you have to have, I hope, some acceptable, non-polluting light industry. Electronics is often mentioned, that sort of thing, but I don't envisage steel mills here.
Right.
Although it's interesting, we need to remember we were in a busy industrial, heavy industrial area. We have roots that way.
Yeah.
But surely we wouldn't spoil the place if we had a Bicron in here or something like that that would be a source of employment. Now, the next question is, do you have the skilled labor for one of them? And you probably don't in the first instance. Becton Dickinson has to bring people all the way in from North Adams, Massachusetts at the moment. And we may not be talking about the same people. That's something to remember here, because while we talk about no opportunities for young people, the young people who are here may not want the opportunities that are offered.
Were you raised in a small town, though?
No, I was born in Dayton, Ohio, went through first grade in Newton Center, Massachusetts, grew up in Evanston, Illinois, which was a suburb. It wasn't a big city, but it was a suburb, and then worked on the Cedar Rapids Gazette before World War II, and landed on the Washington Post because I was stationed on the in the Pentagon at the end of the war. So, went in there.
You've had an interesting time of it.
I did work up in northern Michigan where my grandfather had a cottage. I started a little summer resort weekly and got onto several papers up there as a result of that, and they were very small towns, so that I was familiar with that.
You mentioned some people that we ought to try to interview in relation to specifics. Are there any other people you know, Bob, that we might add to our list?
In
offhand,
well, let's talk about specific subjects that we want to get. This is what I think is important. I've from time to time thought of them, but of course, when I try to dredge them out, I will think of them.
You think them offhand? Yeah. There's no. Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Bob, that we haven't covered?
Well, I should flatter my hosts. I think you two contributed a great deal to this town, and I find it a much more stimulating place because you're here.
Well, thank you. And, we certainly are exhilarated.
How long have you lived here? You, I think
20 years.
20 years.
Well, we came up in 69.
Yeah.
Let me just stop this. And you said that you sing with the...
I sing with the Housatonic's Barbershop Chorus. I've never been with a group that's so congenial. We come from every walk of life, if you will, and several of the people in there I had had some preconceptions about. I had brushed them one way or another, or I had before. I've come to know them and really like them, and this is very refreshing.
How long has that been in existence?
It's, I guess, about 3 years old. I've been in 2.5 years, and had great fun. We practice every Thursday night, and we give full half a dozen concerts or more.
Where do you sing?
We sing at granges, we sing at dinners, we sing at churches of various sorts. We sang for ourselves at our annual dinner Friday night and had a whale of a time.
What kind of music do you sing?
We do stuff composed really largely for the Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America. It's got a pretty mouthful of initials. But orally, the Battle Hymn of the Republics.
Songs you enjoy.
Yeah, very much. That sort of Now the Day is Over. And Lee Collins is a fantastic leader. In fact, he's a fantastic fellow. He's just the man of all seasons here.
Is he a doctor? Yeah, Dr. Collins?
No. Lee Collins is a music teacher at the Cornwall and Kent schools, but he's also the leader of the Salisbury Band, and he does this as a volunteer. You ought to interview Lee. He would be a very important guy to do. He and Barbara Collins, she teaches music in the schools, came up here from New York 20-odd years ago saying, we want the values of a small town for our family, and we're willing to forego city advantages for this. And they've worked with it, and they're just fantastic people. She's very active in the Oblong Valley Players and that sort of thing. And Lee, he's just got his hand in everything. We have a something called the Salisbury Band Christmas Brass and Hot Chocolate Society, and we play Christmas carols around, and I guess we must have played 10 or 12 times this December at various places. We played 3 times in Torrington last weekend, and then last night we played at Pocket Knife Square. Lee has organized that one too. And then we have something called the Senior Hot Shots, and these are adults in the band who get together to play ragtime, and we give concerts around the area.
What's your instrument?
Baritone horn. Mary Lou plays in this now. She plays the piccolo, and she plays flute in the Dorrington Symphony, but she's in this too now.
And how old is this group?
The Hutchards?
The Salisbury Band.
Well, the Salisbury Band was established in 1928, and if you don't have Jimmy Du Bois on this...
I don't think we do.
Oh, well, there, now we're talking. Jimmy Du Bois has been in the Salisbury Band for 61 years. Jimmy is the retired custodian of the Salisbury Central School. And his wife, Olive, whom you may know, is the lady who used to bake the gingerbread village at the White Hart Inn.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And she works at Noble Horizons on weekends. She also works at the Lakeville Journal in the bindery. Jimmy has two artificial knees now and is walking without canes and is doing fine. He's a drummer, and he's played in the band since he was 17 or 18 years old. No pretensions at all, but Jimmy is an absolute gold mine of knowledge and lore about this town. And about some of the miscreants, too.
That's D-U-B-O-I-S?
D-U-B-O-I-S. James. They live in Salisbury. And, long in early October, Olive and Jimmy gave a reenactment of their wedding at the Town Grove, and they invited 300 people to this, and the band played at the Shadow, the Hotshots played, but they went through the ceremony again with John Harney reading it, and it was more fun to watch.
Great idea.
Yeah. Now, these are important people for you to hear.
Yes.
Good.
Ned Swigert, Edward Swigert, S-W-I-G-A-R-T, is the American Indian archaeologist.
Oh, okay. Yes, I've heard that name.
He's a Hotchkiss graduate who grew up on an Indian reservation in either Wisconsin or Minnesota, I believe. And so he knows a lot about this.
Great.
Well, are you through?
Yep.